Omaha Public Radio presents a special program from Project Interfaith on Noon Forum. On September 16, 2002, President George W. Bush declared the week of September 17th through the 23rd as National Constitution Week. In the first of two programs celebrating the first two amendments of the Bill of Rights to the Constitution of the United States, we will hear a lecture given by Dr. Charles Haynes, one of the country's leading scholars on religious liberty and religion in American public life, and author of Finding Common Ground, A Guide to Religious Liberty in the Public Schools and in the Public Square. The topic of his talk will be Religious Liberty in the Public Schools and in the Public Square. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, December 11, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Project Interfaith, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. The exact wording of the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights is, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or of the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances." Here now to introduce the speaker is Beth Katz, Executive Director of Project Interfaith.
Welcome to Religious Liberty in the Public Schools and in the Public Squares, a community conversation with First Amendment Center Senior Scholar Dr. Charles Haynes. I'm Beth Katz, Executive Director of Project Interfaith, and I just want to welcome and thank you all for being here with us to explore a topic that so deeply affects us all. And I know this is such a busy time of year for everyone. We really appreciate you making time to come and be with us and to hear Charles Haynes. I think you'll find him very engaging and full of insight. Tonight's program is part of Project Interfaith's annual speaker series, which we call Community Conversations. And our program tonight is co-sponsored by KIOS 91.5 FM, UNO's College of Education, and its College of Public Affairs and Community Service, as well as the Creighton University Department of Education. We also were fortunate enough to receive funding from the American Academy of Religion, which has enabled us to offer tonight's program to the public at no charge, so we are very grateful for their support. It's my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Dr. Charles Haynes is one of the country's leading scholars on religious liberty and religion in American public life. He is co-author of the seminal resource, Finding Common Ground, A Guide to Religious Liberty in the Public Schools, as well as of five other books, and his column, Inside the First Amendment, appears in newspapers nationwide. Over the past two decades, Dr. Charles Haynes has been the principal organizer and drafter of consensus guidelines on religious liberty in schools. These guidelines have been endorsed by a broad range of religious and educational organizations. He is the founding board member of the Character Education Partnership and serves on the steering committee of the Campaign for the Civic Mission of Schools and the American Bar Association Advisory Commission on Public Education. He also chairs the Committee on Religious Liberty of the National Council of Churches. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Charles Haynes.
Well, thank you very much, Beth. I've only been in Omaha for a day, but I can already tell that Beth Katz is a big community asset. And I'm not just saying that because her mom is here. I would say it anyway. And I think Project Interfaith does great work from all I can gather, from everything I've already gathered. I'm delighted to learn about it and the work it does because, you know, interfaith work done properly can be a tremendous resource in a community. Unfortunately, it's not done so well in many places, and I'll just be honest, it's dying out in lots of places at a time when we most need it. So I think you're very fortunate in this community to have such a vibrant and thoughtful approach to bringing people together to understand their differences and to work together as citizens across differences. So I congratulate Beth for this work and all of those of you who work with her. And thanks also to the other sponsors that have brought us together tonight. Now, I'm going to start with something that may surprise some of you, may be controversial, but I'm going to start with it anyway and see if you agree or not. I think there's a myth about public education today, and I'm going to challenge it right now. You know, we hear a lot about the godless public schools, and that's been a mantra for some time. But actually, the truth of the matter is, and I spend a lot of time in public schools, that there's more student religious expression and more attention to religion in the curriculum in public schools today than at any time since the 19th century. It's extraordinary. But here's the good news about that. Now, for some of you, that sounds, you're going to be nervous about that, and others think that's a good idea. But whatever your view of it, there is some good news about that, for, I think, for all of us. Religion does go to school today. There's no question about that. But mostly, it goes through the First Amendment door. Because over the past two decades, there's been what I call a quiet revolution that's been supported by groups on the right and the left that has actually transformed how many schools deal with religion. And more about that in just a moment. But let me hasten to say, this doesn't mean that all schools are home free or that every conflict over religion is easily resolved. On the contrary, getting religious liberty right in public schools remains a messy business in far too many communities. So, here's the bad news. Yeah, you knew this was coming. The bad news is that some misguided school districts, I hope present company accepted, still attempt to censor constitutionally permissible student religious expression and avoid dealing with religion in the curriculum, avoid teaching about religion. Now there are other misguided school districts that continue to promote school-sponsored religious activities and beliefs in our public schools. And then there are still others, maybe most, that have just attempt to muddle through without policies, waiting for a crisis to happen. So as a result, we still have fights, we still have lawsuits, and most of them are unnecessary. Now, I know most of you think baseball is our national pastime. You're wrong. It's litigation. Really, it is. Now, to understand how we got here, and where we need to go, I think a little history is in order. 20 years ago, to take us back that far, many public schools did, in fact, come close to being religion-free zones. In the wake of controversial Supreme Court decisions banning state-sponsored religious practices, decisions that were, by the way, wildly misinterpreted in the public debate, worried school officials often overreacted by trying to keep all religion out. Textbook publishers largely ignored religion. Teachers wouldn't touch it with the proverbial 10-foot pole. Administrators mistakenly confused student religious expression with government speech and told their kids to, you know, leave their religion outside the schoolhouse door and then come and learn with us. Now, of course, some other schools, particularly in the rural South where I'm from originally, continued to do what they had always done to promote the majority's religion through various school-sponsored practices. They didn't care what the Supreme Court said. They just went about their business. But that was 20 years ago. Today, most, if not all, state social studies standards and textbooks include considerable mention of religion. Though I would say we still have a long way to go to get it right. Student religious clubs meet on hundreds, if not thousands, of high school campuses. The sight of Christian students praying around the flagpole or in the lunchroom is commonplace, and Muslim students are routinely accommodated to perform daily prayers and so forth. So what accounts for this dramatic change in such a short time? I mean, if you know public education, 20 years is actually overnight for reform. No kidding, I mean, it is. Part of the credit, I think, it goes to the consensus guidelines that were developed by leading religious civil liberties and educational groups. You have a couple of them I've given you tonight. 20 years ago, religious liberty attorney Oliver Thomas, Buzz Thomas we call him, and I worked together to convene some of these groups to try to find common ground where there hadn't been any on these issues. We were at that time very concerned about the growing number of lawsuits and fights in the culture wars of the mid-80s. And so we came together and to see if we couldn't do better across our differences. Well, It took a year and a half of intense negotiation to reach that first agreement on religion in the public school curriculum, which, strangely enough, is the first ever consensus statement on how to deal with religion in the public school curriculum in our history. I mean, I don't know how we waited so long. And the statement was endorsed by a broad coalition that included the National Education Association, but it also included the National Association of Evangelicals. So it was a broad spectrum. And it was the first of a series of these common ground agreements that I think did a lot to help transform the religious liberty landscape in public education. The culture war conflicts of the 1980s, including textbook trials in Tennessee and Alabama, if any of you remember those, inspired many of us to come together back then in 1987, 1988. But other developments, of course, contributed to these changes. The Equal Access Act of 1984, which you ought to know something about here in Omaha, that opened the door to student religious clubs. The California History Social Science Framework was very important because it broke new ground in 1989 by really including teaching about religions in the framework for, about what was going to go on in the classroom. But since that first agreement in 1988 on religion in the curriculum, there have been lots of others. Today we have consensus statements on religious holidays. We have one on how to deal with the Bible in public schools. That was a difficult one to broker, but we got it. And a couple of years ago, we even got an agreement, at least on a process, for dealing with sexual orientation in public schools, which is the current most difficult, or one of the most difficult issues that we deal with in public education. Christian Educators Association joined up with GLSEN, which is a leading gay rights activist group, and worked together on these guidelines. Now, of course, we have some distance to go. Agreement on some of these issues, religion in the curriculum, when students may pray together, and those kinds of things, doesn't mean, of course, agreement on everything. Conflicts regarding Bible electives, lawsuits over student religious expression before a captive audience, these kinds of issues are still a stark reminder that we have some work to do. Nevertheless, a growing number of school districts across the nation have used this, what I call, new consensus to move from battleground to common ground on the role of religion in public schools. From Ramona, California, to Davis County, Utah, to Richardson, Texas, to Mustang, Oklahoma, many school districts are successfully translating these national statements into local policies and practices that actually take the First Amendment seriously. How did these districts reach common ground? Well, first, they had to reject the two failed models that have characterized much of the history of religion in public schools. Models that still people carry around as the only two alternatives that we have. Models that still survive in varying degrees in all too many school districts. So let me briefly describe them. The first model is what I call the sacred public school. Now, that's, of course, out of the 19th century when school practices privileged one religion over another. And historically, of course, that was a generalized Protestant Christianity. This is what, we have vestiges of this. Some Americans, we call this as the good old days, you know, the good old days, a time when we all got along in the past, we all shared everything. And people ask me often, you know, why can't we go back to those good old days, you know, when we were all one nation under God and we all agreed? So I just remind them of the Bible wars, for example, of the 19th century, when churches were burned and people died and there were riots over whose version of the Bible would be read in the public schools. Would it be the Catholic Bible or the Protestant Bible? Those were the good old days when we all got along. There were no good old days. In fact, that's why we have such a strong parochial school system in the United States Catholic school system, is because in good conscience, many Roman Catholics couldn't send their kids to Protestant schools. Now, for many Americans, especially many conservative Christians, the fight to preserve the sacred public school is about, of course, much more than that 60-second to whom it may concern prayer, you know, or the creche or the menorah in the hallway. I mean, taken by themselves, they seem to sound small and silly, but it's not really about that. It's about the larger questions of whose schools are these? And even more important, what kind of nation are we? Will we be? So for many people, a lot is at stake in these little fights that we wonder, how can people get so angry about? But it's about these larger questions. The theological, political belief that our nation is in spiritual and moral decline because we fail to acknowledge our dependence on God, this goes all the way back to the Puritan roots of our country, this theological conviction, continues to fuel fights when it translates into the promotion of particular religious beliefs by school officials. Now, a few typical examples. I don't need to give the litany of all the terrible stories, but I'll give just a few just to remind you. A teacher in North Carolina not long ago was suspended for inviting a guest speaker into the classroom to promote Christianity and attack Islam. Or a few years ago, a principal in Mississippi allowed what amounted to a revival meeting and required all the students and faculty in the gym and required all the students and faculty to attend. And in some school districts today, public schools are offering unconstitutional Bible electives that operate largely under the radar in many places. So even if we wanted to go back to the good old days, the sacred public school is no longer tenable in our pluralistic society. More importantly, it is both unjust and unconstitutional. But the second failed model is even more widespread, I would argue. Now, here I'm talking about what I call the naked public school. And that's the mistaken idea that freedom of religion requires public schools to be free from religion. Now, contrary to culture war rhetoric, a naked public school was not mandated by the United States Supreme Court. Now, while it's true that the court struck down teacher-led prayer, school-sponsored devotional Bible reading, and other state-sponsored religious practices, the court has never banned prayer or God from the public schools. Never. Never said that students can't pray in a public school. But of course, you hear that all the time. Moreover, the court has gone out of its way in these decisions to emphasize that teaching about religion, as distinguished, of course, from religious indoctrination, is an important part of a good education. Confusion about Supreme Court rulings and fear of controversy over the past four decades or more has led to horror stories of educators prohibiting student religious expression in schools. This has led many religious people to believe that public schools are hostile to their faith. Now, you know this. All it takes is a few conflicts in a few districts, and all public schools are painted with the same brush. And in the internet era particularly, this is very easy to do. And we all heard the stories, so I won't give a huge list, but a few examples. There was a lawsuit in Pennsylvania not long ago by a parent angry because her child was told that he couldn't dress up as Jesus for the Halloween parade. I know this sounds funny. This was a real lawsuit. These are expensive fights, too. Even though the school allows, of course, students to dress up as devils and witches and skeletons covered with blood, but you can't dress up as Jesus. Can you imagine? This went to the court. I wonder how the judge kept a straight face. Do you ever wonder these things? How does the judge sit there and not just laugh? Or how about the New Jersey girl who was told not long ago that she couldn't sing Awesome God in the school talent show? Remember reading about her? Can you imagine how the community felt about that? You can sing your favorite song, choose any song you want. Oh, but you can't sing that one because, you know, it has God in it. Or the superintendent in Michigan a few years ago who told a student, you can't bring your Bible into the school. A teacher in Texas who asked students to write about their favorite person in history. This is Texas, so you know there's a student who's going to write about Jesus, that's right. This is Texas. And, well, I mean, it's probably true almost anywhere, but particularly in Texas. And when the student wanted to write about Jesus, the teacher said, oh, no, you can't do that here. You got to go choose somebody else. Well, you know, all of these incidents seem to me are caused by a widespread confusion that persists among some school officials about the difference between school promotion of religion, which is prohibited by the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, and student religious expression, which is protected by the free exercise and free speech clauses of the First Amendment. Like the sacred public school, the naked public school is also unjust and in many of its forms unconstitutional. Now, some culture warriors on both sides will tell you otherwise. But I would say Americans do not have to choose between imposing religion in schools or keeping it out altogether. This is a false choice between two unconstitutional, unjust alternatives. If that were our choice, we would be doomed to fight forever over this. These are terrible choices. So the third model, the approach built in this new consensus I've talked about, is what I call the civil public school. It is, in fact, what public schools look like when they actually take the First Amendment seriously. And the civil public school is grounded in the understanding that the First Amendment separates church from state, but not religion from public life or politics in the United States. So, what does a civil public school look like? Well, the best one-stop definition of this civil public school is found in an agreement I helped to negotiate back in 1995 entitled Religious Liberty, Public Education, and the Future of American Democracy. 24 organizations sponsored this agreement, and Principle 4 defines our shared vision for religious liberty in public schools, and it's very simple, four sentences. Public schools may not inculcate nor inhibit religion. They must be places where religion and religious conviction are treated with fairness and respect. Public schools uphold the First Amendment when they protect the religious liberty rights of students of all faiths or none. Schools demonstrate fairness when they ensure that the curriculum includes study about religion where appropriate as an important part of a complete education. So, these four sentences describe what schools look like when we live up to the promise of religious liberty under the First Amendment. Our shared commitment as Americans to no establishment and free exercise. Rather than saying no to religion, the First Amendment actually opens the door to appropriate student religious expression while simultaneously keeping school officials out of the religion business. This statement is extraordinary, not only for what it says, but also for who says it. In what is surely a first, both the Christian Coalition and People for the American Way are on the list. The Christian Educators International, Association International is listed, but so is the National Education Association. The National Association of Evangelicals, the Catholic League for Religious and Civil Rights, the Anti-Defamation League, the Council on Islamic Education, join with the American Association of School Administrators, the National PTA, and the National School Boards Association to endorse this statement. Who says America doesn't work? Within a First Amendment framework, we also now have broad agreement on many of the religious liberty rights of public school students. Under current law, students have the right to pray in public schools alone or in groups as long as the activity doesn't disrupt the school or infringe on the right of others. Students have the right to share their faith with others and to read their scriptures. When it's relevant to the discussion and meets the academic requirements, students have the right to express personal religious views in class or as part of a written assignment. Students have the right to distribute religious literature in school, subject to reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. And under the Equal Access Act, as you well know, students have the right in secondary schools to form religious clubs if the school allows other extracurricular clubs. We also have broad agreement on the need to include study about religion in the public school curriculum. And schools are finally moving from asking, is it constitutional to teach about religion, to asking, how should we do it? 20 years ago, state social studies frameworks ignored religion. Textbooks followed suit. Today, according to a study we published a few years ago, all existing state social studies standards include considerable mention of religion. And as a consequence, history textbooks now integrate some study, at least, of religion into discussions of American and world history. Now, this doesn't mean, of course, that all public schools are now civil public schools or even close to it. Because of our bad history and the ongoing culture wars, many school officials are still afraid to implement this new consensus, if they even know about it. Moreover, some teachers remain skittish about discussing religion, whatever the standards of the textbook say. Getting religious liberty right in every public school won't be easy. An agreement on many issues, such as the place of religion in the curriculum or when students may pray together, doesn't mean agreement on all issues. Consider, for example, the current push for Bible electives across the country. Competing Bible bills are popping up in state legislatures everywhere. Now, if this movement were only about Bible literacy, then legislation wouldn't be necessary because most school districts are free to propose such electives today. But Bible bills in many places appear to be less about education and more about partisan politics and stealth attempts to promote one religious view of the Bible in public schools. And of course, there's also the latest challenge to teaching of evolution from advocates of intelligent design. Now, although a federal judge in Pennsylvania struck down as unconstitutional, as you know, the Dover School District's inclusion of intelligent design in the biology classroom, the fight is far from over. Efforts are currently underway in many states to mandate teaching criticism of evolution in science courses. And of course, the question there is, who gets to decide what is criticism or what the questions are? So more lawsuits on this issue are inevitable. All of these ongoing conflicts involve, of course, deeply held religious and philosophical convictions on all sides, and none are easy to negotiate. Although religious, civil liberties, and educational groups continue to draft consensus guidelines for addressing some of these issues, the real need is for local districts to develop their own policies and practices that's built on this model of a civil public school. Even in those areas where we agree in principle, much work still remains to be done. Apart from more mention of religion and history standards in textbooks, the overall public school curriculum too often still ignores religion. The conventional wisdom of public school educators still in many places appears to be that students can learn everything they need to know about everything and learn almost nothing about religion, and that's a good education. But surely this is wrong-headed. Yes, the curriculum must be neutral under the First Amendment, but it is hardly neutral and certainly unfair to leave religion out and thus implicitly convey the sense that religion is irrelevant in the search for truth. Moreover, study about religions matters because religious freedom matters. The United States is now the most religiously diverse place in the world. And among developed nations, it's one of the most religious. So a simple but profound question confronting our nation and much of the world in the 21st century is, how will we live with our deepest differences? That is to say, how will we live with our deep religious differences? Surely education must play a major role if we are to successfully answer that question. The more we know about one another, the more likely we are to respect the rights of others. Ignorance about religions, in other words, contributes to intolerance and hate. Knowledge about religions contributes to mutual understanding and peaceful coexistence. I'll just add, as a footnote, the Europeans have woken up to this issue. We just completed working, I worked with some folks over there, on guidelines for how to deal with religion in European schools. And even the French representative, this is the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, even the French representative spoke up at the meeting to approve the guidelines and said, we need to do this. I say French because, you know, they don't like anything religious in their public schools in France, including people wearing a headscarf. But even he spoke up and said, you know, we're not going to make it, I'm paraphrasing slightly, if we don't learn about one another. We're not going to be able to live together. So this is an urgent question. It's not just about learning more about religion. Even though we might come to some agreement on the importance of teaching about religion, studying about religion, we have a lot of work to do before we do it properly in public schools. This is not something you just wave a wand and happens. Teacher education will have to change in many places for teachers to receive adequate preparation in the study of religion. More textbooks and supplementary materials that treat religious perspectives accurately and academically will need to be written. And if religious studies electives are to be offered in greater numbers, certified teachers must be available to teach them. Certainly, in other words, enormous challenges remain before the civil public school becomes the universally accepted model for addressing religion in public education. Nevertheless, without minimizing barriers and challenges, it is still fair to say that a shared vision for religious liberty in public schools, a First Amendment vision that includes people of all faiths and none, is much closer to reality today than ever before in American history. And now for the advice part. I'll close with this. There are probably people in this room that know a lot more about running a public school than I will ever know. But I happen to know more about the culture wars than probably most of you know, and I would like to keep it that way. So in my experience, the single most effective way for public schools to avoid lawsuits and fights involving religious issues is to undertake a conscientious, fair, balanced, open approach to developing policies and curriculum. Such a process would seek input from the community and avoid adopting a one-sided agenda from any ideological or religious perspective. So let me give some specific suggestions for local communities. First, take advantage of the legal safe harbor by being proactive. Common ground agreements reached by national groups over the past two decades provide school leaders with really a constitutional safe harbor, or the closest thing we can give you, within which to address religion in the schools. When school officials use these national guidelines to explain the role of religion in public schools under the First Amendment, they build trust among parents and students and increase public support for their school district. So contrary to the myth that somehow if you tackle this, you're going to get in trouble, it's too controversial, it actually can help public schools deepen their support in the community. Two, develop sound policies that reflect a commitment to the First Amendment and an understanding of current law. School districts with sound religious liberty policies are much less likely to experience conflicts and lawsuits over issues related to religion in schools. Some school boards and superintendents appoint a task force that's comprised of educators and community representatives that come together to develop policies that uphold First Amendment principles and current law. And the task force can be used as an ongoing forum for addressing these issues. Building relationships among people of divergent views creates mutual respect and often translates into shared agreements on school policies and practices. I can tell you in communities that do this, the payoff is tremendous. Three, include all sides in the decision-making process. may seem obvious, but it's not so easy for people when there's been a culture war. Public schools belong to all citizens and serve the entire community. Just as these national consensus statements were drafted by people with a broad range of perspectives, so local policies should be developed with input from the stakeholders in the community. In my experience, given the opportunity and using First Amendment ground rules, the vast majority of parents, local leaders, students, educators, and school board members will commit to a principled dialogue and will work for policies and practices that serve the common good. We are very fortunate to live in a country where that is still the case. 4, inform the community on a regular basis. Again, it sounds obvious, but unfortunately, it doesn't happen in many places. No policy, however well-crafted, will be effective unless the broader community is aware of what the policy says and how it's working. Beyond community participation in the policy development process, school leaders should inform parents and other citizens through publications, websites, and regular community meetings about how these policies are being implemented. 5, provide periodic in-service education. Many conflicts over religion in schools, and I've brokered a lot of them, are caused when teachers and administrators are unclear about what is and isn't permissible under the First Amendment. Even the best policies are of little value unless school officials understand how to carry them out. Teaching about religions, for example, requires an understanding of the First Amendment guidelines, adequate academic preparation. School districts should offer periodic in-service opportunities to teachers and administrators focused on the key religious liberty issues that educators are asked to address in the schools. And finally, 6, this is a big one for me, we've got to reform pre-service education. Too few schools of education really do much to address religion in public schools or religious liberty. So few teachers and administrators are actually adequately prepared to deal with these issues when they arise in the classroom and the schools. We can imagine today, in the United States, as diverse as we are religiously, with as many religious conflicts, issues, questions we have, sending a public school principal into their job without preparation to deal with First Amendment conflicts and issues. But we do it all the time. All educators should receive First Amendment training as part of their certification process. Not just a mention in school law, but I mean really something in depth. Talk about free speech issues and other issues as well, not just these issues. Moreover, prospective teachers, in my view, should know something about the relationship of religion to the subjects they will be teaching. And I don't just mean social studies teachers, literature teachers, art, music, so forth. Science teachers need to know something about this as well. National education associations and religious liberty advocacy groups should work together, of course, to bring about these reforms, and local communities should demand them. Because until schools of education take the First Amendment seriously, it will be very difficult for local schools to avoid confusion and conflict and litigation over religion. Well, all of this takes work. But however great the challenge, if public schools expect to thrive in the 21st century, and this, the most religiously diverse place on earth, they have no choice but to move beyond these failed models of our history. This new consensus on many of the religious liberty issues that have long divided us provides school leaders with an extraordinary, historic opportunity to articulate a shared vision for religion and the role of religion in our public schools. As Father John Courtney Murray, who is, of course, as many of you know, a great Catholic theologian and public philosopher, famously reminded us many years ago, the guiding principles of the First Amendment, he said, are not our articles of faith. Most of us have commitments in our lives that are more important to us than civic principles. And it is the constitutional right in this country of every person to follow the dictates of conscience in matters of faith and to make those their deepest commitments. But, he said, the religious liberty principles of the First Amendment are our articles of peace. So can we use our articles of peace to move from battleground to common ground in our public schools? We must. Thank you very much. And now let's open it up to your questions and comments.
First of all, I think you make a very cogent argument for a very fair and intelligent policy. Secondly, I'm going to kind of sneak in a twofer here.
Okay.
Two Supreme Court decisions, one which you alluded to several times, Mergens versus Westside, which has obvious local geographical concerns, about a mile and a half up the street here. And the second court decision is the Bong Hits for Jesus kid. Yeah. And I don't – Freeman, I think
his Morse name was. Morse v. Frederick. Joe Frederick was his name, yeah.
In terms of the Mergens decision, I wonder if you could comment on Justice Stevens' dissenting opinion.
Yes, as many of you know here, especially the decision in Mergens by the Supreme Court upheld as constitutional was the Equal Access Act of 1984 passed by Congress to allow students to form religious and political clubs in secondary schools, public schools, if the school allowed other clubs that weren't related to the curriculum. So if you had a, and it really was pretty strict, if you had a chess club, that triggered the Equal Access Act. You can't say, well, chess is related to math, so it doesn't, you know, no. If you're not teaching the subject, a history club, so that's the idea. So students are then given the opportunity to form religious and political clubs. Now, of course, Justice Stevens and many national groups were concerned that this would open the door to school promotion of religion. It would open the door to pressure, perhaps, on people, students in schools, to join religious clubs and so forth. So there was actually a parade of horribles presented by opponents of the Equal Access Act in Congress and then in Justice Stevens' dissenting opinion. Justice Stevens is still he's now the only really strict separationist on the court. I mean, really strict separationist. And so he's very concerned about the high wall of separation between church and state. So he's often the most separationist voice in these opinions. All one can say about it is that people who opposed it then now say it's working pretty well. The parade of horribles didn't happen. Whatever one thinks of the Equal Access Act back then, today, actually, many of the people who opposed it then, many of the groups, are actually in favor of it because they like the fact the forum is open. In fact, the shoe's a little bit on the other foot because the big fight today is over equal access of the gay-straight alliances in many places. So those people who are really, you know, hot to get this passed and open up the forum so there could be Bible clubs and Christian clubs and so forth are happy about it. But today, they're not so happy that it's opened up the forum to groups that they consider to be offensive and they don't want in public schools. So, but I think for the most part, most people in the religious liberty world think it's working pretty well. I don't think there's much of a view that this was a bad decision, wrong, or it opened the door to all those terrible things. That hasn't stop people from litigating over the Equal Access Act. Mergens was not the last fight, as many of you know. There were other court cases about can these student groups meet at lunch? Or does it have to be before or after school and so forth? And yes, the court said they can meet at lunch if other groups meet at lunch. So every little part of this has been litigated. But I think that right now, most school districts find that it works pretty well. And, they know they don't have to allow extremist groups that promote violence or illegal activity and so forth, so that doesn't happen. And they also like the idea that it gives students an opportunity to have a voice and to organize around interests that they have politically and religiously. There are probably, so there are hundreds of such clubs or thousands of such clubs. I think it's working pretty well. The Frederick case or the Morse case, that Bong Hits for Jesus, people know it as, it at first blush seems to be a small change. That is to say, it expands the power of administrators to censor speech when it relates to drug activity. And some of the votes on the court for upholding the school district in that case and against the student were very strong to say this is very narrow. We're only voting for this because it only carves out this arena for censorship. Having said that, lower courts may use it to expand the power of administrators to censor student speech. And we've already seen in a couple of lower court decisions moving in that direction. So we don't know yet what the implications are for student speech. Tinker still lives. Tinker is, of course, the landmark 1969 decision where the court, for the first time, Supreme Court made clear students, as they said, do not shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate. So that students actually, not only do they have rights, they have rights, they're inalienable, so it doesn't matter if they're students, but they have the right to exercise their freedom in a public school within certain limits. The court has chipped away at that in subsequent decisions, the Frazier decision, Hazelwood decision, and now this decision. So it's chipped away. But nevertheless, Tinker is still good law. And school officials should be very aware that when students express themselves religiously or politically, the school does not have the power to censor that speech, unless, of course, it's vulgar and obscene, Frazier, it's in a school-sponsored newspaper, Hazelwood, or it's about drugs, Bong Hits for Jesus. So, you know, the court has kept giving, and I think, you know, one can understand that. I mean, this is a school. This isn't the public square. And so the court has tried to find a way to uphold freedom of speech and free exercise of religion for students, but with the limits appropriate to an educational setting. It's a tough balancing act, and I don't envy the justices having to do it. So, is that pretty much? Yes, sir.
Isn't the teaching of evolution how much and how definite still one of the biggest things that the ordinary schools have to deal with?
The controversies over teaching evolution or teaching about teaching evolutionary theory are, yes, one of the still most emotional and contentious issues in some parts of the country more than others. There is not a lot of common ground on this for those who feel strongly about it. Challenges to the teaching of evolution have been with us, of course, a long time, and I think will still be with us for a long time. The challenge for me on this is that if anything I say on this would be misheard, and that's not me, it's just this is the issue. You cannot almost say anything. People are going to mishear you and put you on one side or the other. That's how polarized we are about this. So I've been working with a colleague, a good friend of mine, to draft a kind of common ground approach to this, and we are trying. We don't have many takers. We don't have people who say, let's get together and work on this, because even to get together and work on it is seen by some people as a compromise. That's how polarized this is. So this issue really isn't about education. What is good science education? That would be an interesting and important question. What would be a good science education? I wish we could ask that question and then sit together and think about it. This is about politics and emotion, and it's a very deep fight. My argument with people in the science community, the major associations, is, look, you may feel as though you have won the day in the courts so far, and this lower court decision in Dover certainly, but are you losing the war? the hearts and minds of people? And are you hurting science education by not thinking a little bit more broadly about how to address this, rather than simply saying, let's just keep all of this out? Because what happens is that science teachers then often feel they are unable to teach freely, and science textbooks often are very afraid to really deal in depth with things. So is it helping science education, this strategy of just either or winner take all, legal fights? But my argument with the other side, or sides, there are many different perspectives, is look, you know, this is the teaching of evolution is the prevailing paradigm in science. It informs the biological sciences deeply. And it's important to acknowledge that, address that in a way that opens the door to conversation and not just simply says, you know, it's, again, either or, winner take all. I actually think that science education would be well served, and here I'm going to be misunderstood, but I think it would be well served by informing students about the context of this discussion. I actually think students should be let in on this. Because if we really want Americans to accept what science is teaching and understand it, and the polls say they don't, even though they took the courses, they don't. They reject it. So something's not working. But if we really want people to be educated about what science is about, I think we have to let students in on this discussion. I think we have to give them some historical context and philosophical context for understanding this debate. We do nothing, almost, well, really nothing, in science education about the history of science. The relationship between religion and science through the centuries. The current relationship between religion and science. I mean, folks, if Harvard University and others can have these conferences on spirituality and health and all of these kinds of interesting intersections of religion and science, why is it that we can't somehow let students in on that there's a conversation, there's a history, there's a dialogue, there is some way to talk about this? Philosophically, of course, there's a long discussion in philosophy about what is science, different views of it, and so forth. Students don't have that context, so they don't really understand this fight, or they hear in their church one thing, they hear in the science classroom the other thing, and often they just reject what they hear in their schools because they don't really have a context. So if I really could wave a wand on this and get rid of some of the politics, I think we could come together and say, what in a biology textbook could we put there in the introductory chapter that would prepare students to understand this discussion and the controversy surrounding it today? I think that would be intellectually honest. I think it would also require letting students know what the intelligent design people, for example, today are saying. What do they say? Why? Where? What is the tradition they're coming out of? But also say why the science community, majority of science community in the associations, don't believe that that's how you define science and so forth and so on. What is being said? And the rest of the textbook, of course, is going to have to reflect what is the consensus in the science community students need to know to understand science. But I think they will be more likely to engage that, understand that, if they had some of these philosophical, historical tools. But that's just my opinion. To even advance this argument in the science community is very, very difficult. So the most important civic lesson we can teach before students graduate from our schools is that how they treat people when they're in the majority will determine how their rights will be protected when they're not. If they can graduate with this understanding of civic responsibility and commitment to fundamental rights, then I think we've done our job in public education. And yes, we can live with deep religious differences in the 21st century. Well, thank you very much. I see my time is up.
You've been listening to a program from Project Interfaith on Noon Forum. We've heard a lecture by Dr. Charles Haynes, one of the country's leading scholars on religious liberty and religion in American public life, and author of Finding Common Ground, A Guide to Religious Liberty in the Public Schools and in the Public Square. The topic of his talk was Religious Liberty in the Public Schools and in the Public Square. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, December 11, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Beth Katz, Executive Director of Project Interfaith, for helping to make the recording and rebroadcast of this program possible. Be sure and listen next Monday, September 21st at 12 noon, for the second program in our special presentation in celebration of National Constitution Week, September 17th through the 23rd, proclaimed by President George W. Bush on September 16, 2002. Next week's program will present a debate regarding the legalized concealed carry of weapons on college campuses, recorded last year at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.